ready when y'all are, I guess.
All right, ready?
Yep.
All right, 3, 2, whatever. What is good, everybody? It's your boy Francis Carlotta on episode 51 of the Up and Under podcast. Look, we're in the playoffs, and I know that as a pod, we've been lacking for for content. We've had a busy schedule. Grant has just saw Billy Joel this weekend. Connor has business school finals. And so we've been busy. I don't know what to tell y'all. I'm sorry. I feel bad. I wish we had a little more time, but you know, it's life. It's how it goes sometimes. But I am here today and no Grant and Connor. So maybe someone better, maybe he's better. Well, at the very least, he's a fantastic person. He knows his basketball. He's a contributor, writer for Bluff City Media. He writes about the Grizzlies. He does insider insights. He does features. He's incredibly talented, and it's just an honor to have him on the podcast. Brandon Nwokiji, what's going on, dude? How are you doing? Welcome to the Up and Under podcast.
Hey, Francis. Super excited to be here. It's kind of surreal, you know, being on this pod with you. You're one of the first people I actually met on like sports Twitter, sports media.
Yeah.
And big fan of your work and your writing with Bluff City Media as well. Everything you do with the Grizzlies and the Tigers. So thanks for having me on, man.
Yeah, I appreciate it, man. The kind words are definitely appreciated. Fun fact for all the listeners, I actually went to school with Brandon's sister when we were younger. And then I saw Brandon on Twitter, and I saw his last name, and I'm like, I know that last name. I do. I swear. I know this last name. But I didn't really know Brandon that well, so I was like, maybe I'll wait. You know, I'll wait a little bit before I just, like, DM him out of the blue to be like, hey, is Brianna Nwokiji your sister? Like, out of the absolute blue. And then I did, and you were like, yeah, that's my sister. And I was like, oh, shit. Like, small world, man. It's crazy how small of a world this is.
Yeah, man, it's something just kind of really special when you can connect with Memphis people, in this space, and connect with like people who are from your community. We went to, you and my sister went to the same primary school growing up, mm-hmm. and everything. So, I mean, it's just like how crazy, like how small the world is, truly.
Yeah. Yeah, it's pretty insane. And then at the same time, we both live in the West Coast. I'm in San Diego. You're in LA, and we're both trying to be a part of this, you know, Memphis Twitter, Memphis sports atmosphere. And I think you've done a phenomenal job getting yourself ingrained in the Memphis Twitter, Memphis sports culture. And you know, I'm trying to do my best to do the same thing. But it's weird because like we love Memphis, we love the city, we love Memphis sports, but we have to be a part of it in a different manner. Have you found it difficult for you to try and find yourself into these spaces though you don't live in Memphis anymore?
Yeah, I will say like it's something different, right? When you're on like the opposite side of the country essentially, and you can't go to like the home games at the FedEx Forum and like get quotes for a story or like get quotes for a feature or anything like that. But in this new age of technology that we're in and just like interconnectedness, I feel like it's less of an issue now just because we have things like Twitter spaces.
Yeah.
We have things like Twitter where we can connect with other people in your community about the game and about the Grizzlies and about the following. And, you know, shout out Grindhouse, who runs the Grizzly spaces,
for sure.
Because it's brought me closer to like that Memphis community and the Grizzlies and everybody there. So while I am like located very far away from my hometown right now, the, that kind of like gap, I feel like is made pretty it's pretty moot due to the interconnectedness of this new technological age that we're in.
Yeah, I agree. There's not too much for me to add because that's exactly how I feel. It's been, you know, I had an initial Twitter that I've had since I was in freaking middle school that I've had for such a long time that, you know, I always talked about sports and whatever on it. But then my then girlfriend at the time was like, you know, if you as you're someone who's trying to make your name in sports media one day, you should probably just make a sports account. So I did that. And it took a while, you know, it took time, but you know, like you said, through technology, through Twitter, through engagement with people, it's been able to at least open the door for us for us to make some form of a name in a city that we don't live in. And it's awesome. And it's awesome to see you thriving as a sports writer, as a sports personality on Twitter. It makes me happy to see. So let's get into it, man. You know your ball, and I'm excited to talk with you about the playoffs so far. So let's go backwards. Let's go backwards before we look at where we're at now in the second round of the NBA playoffs. Brandon, it's no secret. We're Grizzlies people. We write about the Memphis Grizzlies, and they suffered a loss in the first round as the 2 seed against the 7 seed Los Angeles Lakers. So I'll keep my first question very open-ended. Just leave it, take it wherever you want to. Thoughts on the series? How are you feeling? You know, the series ended about a week ago, so there's been time to, I guess, reflect on what's happened. So what are your thoughts?
Yeah, so when I think about this series with the Grizzlies and the Lakers, I think going in, there was an understanding that things really had to go right for the Grizzlies, right? Like, things really had to line up perfectly just because, of course, like, you had Steven Adams injured, out with the knee. You had Brandon Clark. He tore his Achilles, so he wasn't going to be playing as well. Ja Morant, he had the injured hand from the Milwaukee game that he injured in game one, that he kind of re-injured in game one. So there's just a lot of key players were either out of action or hobbled. So it was going to be a slim window to victory, just no matter what, with everything that just kind of lined up for the Grizzlies this year. They didn't get that injury luck. And yeah, I felt like during that series, all of the issues that the Grizzlies, we had talked about with the Grizzlies having during the year, such as bad half-court offense, not really getting back in transition, certain players taking too many shots, like all of those issues that certain the Grizzlies players had. Certain players, yeah. Dylan Brooks, yeah, Dylan Brooks.
Okay, there,
I'll come right out with it.
Yeah.
But it just kind of felt like all those issues during the regular season that plagued the Grizzlies, they really came to the forefront during this series. It just didn't really look like the Grizzlies wanted it from the jump. Every single game, that hustle and that energy was just lacking. The Lakers' defense, I mean, it effectively locked the Grizzlies up. They collapsed onto the paint with Dylan taking all of those shots, and Dylan Brooks taking a ton of those threes made it much better, much easier for the Lakers to pack the paint, force Ja into really contested jumpers. Made it easier for them to get double teams onto Jaren so he can really operate in the paint. Desmond Bane also, he couldn't really get it going. His shots weren't really falling until I'd say like game five, which limited the Grizzlies' offensive attack, because Desmond Bane, as a three-level scorer, opens up the offense for the Memphis Grizzlies. So if he's not hitting shots, if he's not really getting to his spots on the perimeter and hitting those shots, the offensive attack is going to be very limited. And there was just too much ball watching all around. I thought the Grizzlies just let themselves get manhandled on the glass. Of course, like, because the Grizzlies didn't have Steven Adams, who is right. one of the best offensive rebounders in the NBA, they yeah. didn't have that ability to effectively thwart Anthony Davis, one of the league's premier big men, from only getting to his spots in the paint and really getting those, especially those offensive putbacks as well, which Davis is really skilled at getting. Right. And so they just, I just thought the Grizzlies from the jump, they didn't really look like they wanted it. Whether that's due to like a lack of key players or a lack of injuries or the injuries to key players or mm-hmm. just a lack of available players, they just didn't really look like they wanted it. And that lack of energy, that lack of focus and that hustle was just on display throughout the entire series.
Yeah, I think you bring up some really, really interesting points. I mean, first thing, like your point about the Grizzlies kind of had to play a damn near perfect series to beat the Lakers. I think that's such an interesting thing to think about because there were some people in Memphis Twitter, Memphis sports Twitter, Memphis media personalities who thought this would be a cakewalk to beat the Lakers. They thought it would be easy. They would say things like, "Oh, they're the seventh seed for a reason," and trying to talk down on the Lakers' impressive finish to the regular season. And I'm on record stating this, that, you know, the Lakers, if healthy, which they were healthy for the whole entire seven games, well, six game series, but you know what I mean. They were healthy for the whole series. And if that happened, this is a horrible matchup for Memphis. It was never a good matchup if the Lakers were fully healthy. Now, that was a big if, because you can never fully trust Anthony Davis to be healthy or LeBron James. And then when you look at game one, AD's arm gets hurt and he says, "I can't move my arm." And look, no one wishes ill will on Anthony Davis, but I think a lot of Grizzlies fans were like, "All right, yeah, I mean, there you go. That's what we expected. We expected him to get hurt at some point during the series. Yeah. And then maybe, hey, if he's out, then we're going to win this series because the Lakers aren't going to be healthy." Then he comes back in the second half, and then obviously the Lakers take game one for not because AD comes back. There's a plethora of reasons why they stole game one. But obviously Ja's injury doesn't help things at the end of that game, as we know. But AD and LeBron stayed healthy. So it was always a weird take from some people that, "Oh, this would be easy." Like, nah, man, the Lakers are very good. They can defend. They can shoot. They have superstars who know exactly who they are in the playoffs. They know they trust themselves. They know their roles. They know how dominant they are and can be. So yeah, this was always a hard matchup. So I agree and with your point that the Grizzlies had to damn near play a perfect series with their injuries in mind. And then your point about the health, that's another thing that I 100% echo, because I say this for years. The healthiest team will win the NBA title. And that's just how it's gone for the past few years, that it's been a war of attrition in the regular season and even in the playoffs. And if you're the healthiest team consistently, you have a damn good shot to win the NBA title. And the Grizzlies were not that team. They were the opposite of healthy. And then even with no Steven Adams, with no Brandon Clark, the Grizzlies had a fighting chance because Luke Kennard was so damn good. But then he gets hurt and he's not available game six. And as you touched on as well, they had no spacing. They had nobody to give Ja space to be Ja Morant in the paint. Yeah. And the Lakers just funneled shots to a certain Dylan Brooks, who, well, didn't knock shots down. Like, you know, put it lightly. Yeah. I'll put it lightly. I mean, I'm in a good mood on a Monday morning. So, yeah, it was unfortunately the perfect storm for the Grizzlies to lose this series. I will push back on I think the Grizzlies definitely had the fight. I think they showed the want to win the series until they lost game four. When they lost game four, they lost in overtime. I think that loss, and yeah, they won game five, but you expected that. You expect the Grizzlies to come home, you know, fight for their lives on the home court. But after that game four loss, you just kind of knew that the series was over, because it's going to be very hard, if not impossible, to win three games in a row against LeBron in the playoffs.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, I that game six performance backs up your point that they had that fight just wasn't there. You didn't see that want to, especially in game six. But I think it was there up until the buzzer sounded at the end of overtime in game four. But yeah, those are, I loved your points. Any other thoughts on the series?
Yeah, I will say when you talk about like that, when I talk about the lack of fight, I think a really big thing is just like the Grizzlies couldn't really hit shots all throughout the series.
Yeah.
And a big part of that, of course, was Desmond Bain, because he is the Grizzlies' best perimeter creator. He's the Grizzlies' best three-level scorer, one of the best three-level scorers in the NBA. And yeah. He just wasn't hitting his shots. Of course, Dylan Brooks wasn't hitting his shots. The bench wasn't hitting their shots. So I think a huge thing is just the Grizzlies couldn't hit shots, really throughout the game, whether it was open or contested. The Lakers get, because let's get one thing straight. The Lakers gave the Grizzlies plenty of open looks, whether that was from three or mid-range, whatever. But the Grizzlies just couldn't knock those down. And for whatever reason, and I think that just kind of did them in. It never really felt like during that series the Grizzlies had one kind of like great shooting game. Maybe the first win, was pretty close, but I just never felt like the Grizzlies could ever hit shots during that series.
No, I agree. I definitely agree. Like the shots just weren't falling. At the end of the day, you win basketball games by making shots. Like it's an oversimplification, but it's true. And the Grizzlies didn't make open shots. So let me, I made keys to the series before the series started. So I just wanted to quickly, run through them and discuss, well, not to say that I was right. Cause I hate in this context to be correct. But so my first key was Jaren Jackson Jr. He had to be incredible. He had to be the Jaren Jackson Jr. of the last 20, 25 games of the regular season, where offensively he looked incredible. I mean, he was a dominant force offensively. And then defensively, I mean, he's a defensive player of the year. We know that. But he had to carry on his offensive stretch of games into the postseason, especially going up against Anthony Davis, to give Grizzlies the best chance. Brandon, that didn't happen at all. After a great game one, man, and where everyone thought Jaren had arrived, like everybody on Grizzlies Twitter and Grizzlies media was like, the only positive from losing game one was how good Jaren Jackson played. He was amazing. Like, you know, let's hope he can continue this. The rest of the series, Brandon, he averaged 13.8 points, 8.4 rebounds, which is good. That's good to see his rebounds numbers up. 4 blocks and steals, which is fine. But for the season, he averaged around 5. And then he shot 35.8% from the field and 24.7 from 3. That's horrible. Like let's just be very frank about that. His shooting numbers were horrible. His offensively, Jaren was horrible, and it's disappointing because like I mentioned, he was so good game one. He was spectacular. He looked like the offensive force that we know he can be, and so that was disappointing. So that key gone. Spacing for Ja was my second key. And what I meant by that was obviously three-point shots need to go in, because with no Brandon Clark, no Steven Adams, Brandon Clark, I think is when you look at when you watch Grizzlies basketball, BC is like that pressure valve, pressure releaser at the rim. So when Ja gets downhill, there's a lob threat right there. Brandon Clark is a perfect guy to be in the dunker spot to really take away the pressure all on Ja when Ja gets downhill. And then when Ja gets downhill, who creates the space for him to do that? It's Steven Adams. I mean, I'm not telling you something you don't already know, Brandon. Like, we know how vital Steven Adams is to Ja Morant's game.
Oh, yeah.
So, no other than there, where did the spacing come from? It had to come from three-point shooting, and you already mentioned that the Grizzlies sucked from three. They didn't make any shots. You know, Luke Kennard was really good, but then he gets hurt for game six, and there's just zero spacing for Ja at all. So that one, gone. Win the turnover battle was my third. The Grizzlies were +2, so yay. You know, check in that category, I guess. Cool. Then the last one was youth had to mature. And, you know, you're a big David Roddy guy, and I ate some crow on my David Roddy takes, and I get it. He's been impactful. But he didn't, you know, not to say he was bad. in against the Lakers, but he wasn't that impactful. I wish he got more minutes. You know, I wish he played over Dylan Brooks at times. But you know, even in their Game 5 win where they blew the Lakers out, Roddy played 1 minute in that game. And I'm not saying that's on him, but it's more so Luke Kennard was really good, and you had to run lineups with Kennard, and I was just hoping for more of an impact from Roddy. Same thing from Ziaire, but you know, it seems like he lost the trust of Taylor Jenkins because he didn't get any playing time, and that, you know, he already had a disappointing season. And then Kenneth Lofton Jr., Brandon, I'm not gonna get on a soapbox about this. I've already ranted about this to friends at bars. I don't need to get on a massive soapbox, but I will just say, I just don't understand how, you know, you need a big, and then you sign Kenneth Lofton Jr. from his two-way. You give him a contract. Good for him. But then you don't play him. And I'm just like, why? Why are you not playing this guy? You know you need a big man. You know you need someone else to be a body down low. That's why you sign Kenneth Lofton Jr. You're telling me they couldn't have tried to get somebody else from a buyout? And I know that's easier said than done. I get it. But it was weird. It was very odd for me to see Lofton not get any play after you release Kennedy Chandler, and you know you only have three point guards. I don't know. It was very odd. Do you have any thoughts on that, Brandon?
Yeah. So in terms of Kenneth Lofton Jr., or as the Grizzlies community likes to call him, baby back buckets.
That's good.
I kind of knew from the jump, right? When they had signed him that late in the season, after the news kind of dropped that Steven Adams was ruled out for most of the postseason. They didn't officially rule Steven Adams out, right? They said,
yeah.
That was also just weird. Just super weird situation.
So weird.
All around. But I kind of knew, like, they were headed in the direction with Kenneth Lofton of, okay, we're only going to sign this guy because we need insurance as a backup big. Like, Kenneth Lofton Jr., I'm a huge believer in Kenneth Lofton Jr.'s talent. That dude's a post-technician. The way he just kind of gets to the post, gets his moves to get to the basket. You know, baby Zebo, right? His game mirrors so much of what Zach Randolph brought to the Memphis Grizzlies on that grit and grind team. But he never really got a ton of minutes during the regular season, right? In that first half of the season, he only kind of played blowout minutes. In the second half, post All-Star break, Jenkins did start incorporating him into the lineup a bit more, not as much,
slightly.
Slightly. I think that it was the game against the Spurs in which he came in early in the first quarter. He got like pretty consistent minutes that game, but you know, aside from that and like some other games, he hadn't really had a ton of regular season action. And so just kind of like thinking about like the way this coaching staff operates and the way Jenkins operates, I didn't expect Kenneth Lofton Jr. to get huge minutes in the postseason just because they hadn't given him a ton of run during the regular season, whether that's like with the starting unit, with the bench unit. I had kind of known at the back of my mind, okay, like this is just kind of insurance in case somebody, God forbid, like gets hurt or injured. It's just a lot to ask for a guy who is coming off a G League contract that he performed exponentially well in. You know, like G League Rookie of the Year.
Right.
Big shout out to him. But it's a lot to ask for that guy to play playoff minutes. You know, like to play postseason basketball. And I did not expect the Grizzlies, just kind of knowing how this coaching staff operates, to give Kenneth Lofton those minutes, although I am a firm believer of his talent. I believe he has a big future with this team. I just didn't see it. I didn't expect the coaching staff to give him a ton of run there.
Yeah, and also, again, I agree. I'm not clamoring for more Kenneth Lofton Jr. minutes against the Lakers. Like, I definitely understand, and I'm with you. It was just weird to me. It was just, and we're, I guess this is kind of another point because I'll ask you in a moment. I'll just ask you now and transition to my answer. What are the positives to take away from this the series. Obviously, it's disappointing to see the Lakers, to see the Grizzlies lose in the first round as the two seed after a fantastic regular season, up and down to say the least. But still, yeah, you're the two seed in the Western Conference. That's a good, that's a damn good regular season, and you're expected to have some form of postseason run, and it doesn't happen. You lose in the first round, so it's definitely disappointing. So I think the biggest positive, the takeaway, are just the lessons that the players, the coaches, and this front office are learning. Hopefully, they've learned from this series, because you know, in terms of players, well, I'm not trying to make this into a Dylan Brooks podcast, but you know, he's not going to be a Grizzly anymore, as we're all well aware of. Yeah. And I'm not saying he's a scapegoat. I'm not saying that the Grizzlies lost because of Dylan Brooks. But I think at the same time, there's something to learn from the what happened with Dylan Brooks, and maybe what maybe permeated throughout the Grizzlies roster in terms of their approach to the series and their approach to playing LeBron, playing the Lakers. You saw when they came out Game 3 on the road, they looked flat. They were terrible, as we all know. The moment was way too big for them for whatever reason. Was it the trash talk from Dylan Brooks? Was it just the team trying to back him up or feel like, you know what, maybe we're not trying to associate with him? Either way, I think the lessons from – I think they'll mature from this series. Hopefully, that's the goal, of course. Coaching-wise, I think they'll learn from the rotations. They'll actually play their best lineups more often. You saw that slightly, especially in Game 5 with Luke Kennard. They played him a lot of minutes. They played him with Desmond Bane, with John Morant, and allowed them spacing. So hopefully that the rotations and lineups get tighter, because they need to be. When you get into the postseason, Brandon, your lineup, your rotations need to be perfect, perfect to win a series against the best teams in the NBA. Just look at what Milwaukee just did with Mike Budenholzer. They fired him because they were the one seed, and his rotations and his decisions, his coaching decisions, were horrible. They were not good, and we'll talk about Bud and Milwaukee in a moment. But either way, and then front office is the last point I wanted to make. In the exit interviews for Zach Kleiman, and I love Zach Kleiman. all hail King Kleiman. But you know, he's not immune to criticism either. And I think he said something very fair in his exit interview, where he was like, "Yeah, maybe I shouldn't have tripled down on youth." Oh, yeah. Yeah, no shit. Like, are you kidding? Of course not. Like, are you serious? You probably shouldn't have signed Kenneth Lofton Jr. knowing that you need a backup big to not play him. You probably should have tried to exercise the buyout market or find someone who could actually fill in minutes and be impactful, because otherwise it's just a wasted roster spot, and you don't have room for that when you don't have Steven Adams, you don't have Brandon Clark. You're not playing Santi Aldama a bunch of minutes in the postseason. Santi's had a good season, but I don't want to see him playing 27 minutes a game in the first. I don't want to see that, man. Like, that, it, he shouldn't have tripled down on youth. And you can go all the way back to the draft. You know, it's going to be time, and not going to be, it is time for the Grizzlies to put up or shut up. I think that's a really key offseason for them. And I think they'll try and make a move. They'll try and make a trade. It's my belief that there's no reason for the Grizzlies to use their first round pick this year. I don't want them to. If they end up using their first round pick, I will be disappointed. I want them to trade for somebody, use their assets, their plethora of assets, to really get someone impactful. Just look at what the Knicks did with Josh Hart. That's a great example of a trade that, you know, on the surface it may not seem like a big deal, but Josh Hart is a serviceable player in the postseason that you can count on, who provides you value. And it took a first-round pick to get him, that just one, to get Josh Hart, and he's playing well for the New York Knicks. Like, it's a move like that that, you know, it goes against the youth movement of the Memphis Grizzlies and Grizz Next Gen. But I think it's time to get past that era of Grizz Next Gen and try and actually make moves for veteran guys who can impact winning on this roster. So I hope they learn from that. But what about you? What are positives for you to take away from the series?
Francis, I really don't think you could have put it any more perfectly. You know, granted, Grizzlies had a lot of injuries, right? They were missing key players, but there's no like ifs, ands, or buts about it. This was a failure. I mean, just going into the season where Zach Kleiman, like you said, he tripled down on youth. He got rid of DeAnthony Melton and Kyle Anderson, who were two really pivotal players, not just like on the court, right? Those were two great defensive players. They could force those deflections. They could push the ball up in transition, force steals, do all of that. But they were just two really important veteran players in kind of keeping that culture steady in Memphis, keeping that winning culture steady. It's important to have like those players on the roster. And when Kleiman traded them and got rid of them, I guess the front office's kind of line of thinking is that, okay, we can draft a ton of rookies and draft a ton of rookies as well as give John Conchar that contract extension, and there won't really be like a sizable difference, right? Like that was kind of, those are their thoughts. They tripled down on youth and they move forward with that idea of sustained success and kind of building through the draft. And it blew up in their face this season. The guys just weren't ready when they stepped up into those roles. And you know, who can really kind of ask for that when you're a like 20, 21 year old rookie going on to a team with championship aspirations? It's a lot to ask for. But but like Kleiman said, like, it was a mistake to triple down on youth. You can't look, when you're a team, when you're a young team in the NBA and you're competing and you're winning games, you have to make a really pivotal decision. Do you want to build a really good young team, or do you want to win a championship? You can't have it both ways. And I think the front office, they thought they could have it both ways. They thought we can, you know, kind of plug and play youth into this starting lineup and a ton of rookies and be successful. And it didn't work out. I mean, it just plainly, simply did not work out. But like they say, failure is the world's greatest teacher. Mm-hmm. I think this experience is really going to force Memphis to take a long look at their roster and make the moves necessary to build a championship team. I mean, they just have to, because this team around, let's be frank, the biggest assets on this team, the people who are going to lead the Grizzlies to a championship, are your big three: Ja Morant, Jaren Jackson Jr., Desmond Bain. You need to give them players around them who can properly support them, hit shots when necessary, play the defense, you know, do the fundamentals, and do those things to win you games. And clearly tripling down on youth is not going to do that. Veteran presence and veteran players are needed on this team. And so I think the biggest positive that I take away from this is that this is really going to force the Memphis Grizzlies to get serious. It's really going to force them to make those moves necessary to build a championship team, because clearly it just doesn't work. And then on the coaching side too, Jenkins, this was a really turbulent year for Jenkins. Whether that's, you go into a ton of things, but I really want to go into the offensive play calling. It was really lackluster. It was really basic. It was really simple. A ton of pick and rolls, a ton of jog, get a basket, a ton of Jaren face up from the top of the key, or a ton of, you know, give it to dribble handoffs to Desmond Bane. It's like a variation of like those four or five kind of like offensive set plays. And there's no diversity in this Grizzlies offense. There's no creativity. And when you saw in that series, when the Lakers can effectively remove a lot of those options, like they packed the paint, they face guarded Desmond Bane, they took his shots away, they made it hard for Ja to get into the paint. When teams take those like four or five kind of basic like offensive go-tos away, Jenkins, he couldn't adjust. I mean, just plain and simple. He didn't know how to adjust. He looked like he was in over his head. He did not know how to get this offense going. And like, I'll go 50-50, right? Because Jenkins is not, he's not on the floor taking these shots. Like, he's not on the floor dribbling the basketball. It's 50-50 on players and coaching. But I think Jenkins' inability to just adjust and also bring creativity to this offense, especially with Ja Morant and Jaren Jackson, right? These are two phenomenal young players, two of the best young players in the game of basketball. And we're coming up on year four for Ja, right? Mm-hmm. Coming up on year four for Ja, year three for Jaren, and they still don't really have that seamless chemistry that they can use to kind of be explosive together as a duo. And that's really glaring. It's a lot of things kind of piling up for Jenkins, with the main kind of message being this Grizzlies offense lacks diversity, it lacks creativity, it lacks any kind of flair, it lacks any kind of spice. It's a lot of, they say insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result. In my opinion, that's what this Grizzlies offense is. It's just doing a ton of the same things over and over again, and it's clearly not being successful, and Jenkins just didn't adjust to it. So I think, to sum all this up, I think this series is really going to force the Grizzlies to turn things around because they need to. You can't be second in the West back-to-back years and not and the first year you got out in the second round, second year out in the first round. It's becoming really clear that whenever the Grizzlies face these more experienced veteran teams, they're just in over their head because Jenkins doesn't know how to adjust. The offense doesn't have that spark. It doesn't have that creativity. And so this loss, this loss in the first round is really going to make Memphis make those moves necessary to build a championship team. And it starts with the wing. Let's be clear about that. They need a 3-and-D player who can play defense, who has length, who can make those shots and take those threes as necessary. But that's really the biggest takeaway. It's going to force the Grizzlies to get serious. I mean, they have to get serious if they want to compete. And just one last thing I want to put in there. I think a huge positive from the series was Xavier Tillman Sr.
Yeah.
I've been one of Xavier Tillman's biggest fans ever since he came into the league. I watched him at Michigan State a lot, but in that series, I thought he had a great series.
I agree.
Just full on point. I mean, he limited AD for a lot of offensive possessions, limited LeBron for a ton of offensive possessions. I thought he just embodies a Memphis Grizzly to me. He's someone who embraces the grind, goes to work, puts his head down, and does what he needs to do for this team to be successful. And we saw that during that series. Of course, like, he has his offensive limitations. He can't create a ton, but I thought during the series, it just kind of showed that there's a player on this roster who can be an effective defensive deterrent to two star players in this league. He had one of the lowest field goal percentages allowed for opponents in the playoffs during this playoffs. He was effectively one of the best defenders during these NBA playoffs while the Grizzlies were in it. So to put it simply, he looks the part. And I think the Grizzlies, of course, they're facing a lot of tough decisions just kind of like moving forward with this offseason. But I honestly do believe that Xavier Tillman has a place on this team for what he can do defensively. First and foremost, he can switch on to guards, he can switch on to wings, he can limit star players. But I thought that was just a really big bright spot of what was otherwise just a really depressing series. Just the play of Xavier Tillman and what he can bring to this Memphis Grizzlies team.
Yeah, no, that's another awesome point. The X defensively, I mean, he looked like Draymond Green in his prime. He's Draymond's an undersized guy who can guard 1 through 5, and that's kind of what X looked like, an undersized guy who could guard 1 through 5. He moved his feet really well against LeBron. He uses strength to bully Anthony Davis. He has really long wingspan, so he uses length to bother AD as well and LeBron. I mean, on the last possession of regulation in game 4, X played good defense. He played good defense. LeBron just hit a phenomenal shot over both the outstretched arms of Jaren and Xavier Tillman. But X did a good job throughout the whole series, and that's a great point that you bring up on X. Just briefly, Jaren's entering his sixth year, Jaw's entering his fifth, but even then, they've got to figure out a way to, their chemistry together still can improve a lot, especially their pick and roll chemistry. It feels Jaw played his best when Jaren played his best when Jaw wasn't on the floor, when Jaw was hurt or when Jaw was suspended during the regular season. And that, offensively, and that has to change. The Jenkins has to figure out a way. Jaw, Jaren, Dez, Jenkins, they all of them have to figure out a way to maximize all of them on the floor at the same time. And that's something for them. You know, that's not on us. That's on, they got to figure that out for them to maximize themselves offensively. But I think those are, again, wonderful points that you made. So let us transition to, well, again, we could talk Grizzlies for the whole pod. I have so many questions to talk, but this is still an NBA pod. But I think we made awesome points about the Grizzlies and about the series. I mean, long story short, they're gonna have to do a lot of soul searching. So it'll be an important offseason. That's the very least. They already made the decision to not bring back Dylan Brooks. That was one important decision that they've already made. And so we'll see what's next. It's going to be fascinating, to say the very least. But all right, so let's move on to another big headline in the NBA. The Milwaukee Bucks, the one seed in the Eastern Conference, lost in the first round in 5 games to the Miami Heat. And they fired their coach. They fired Coach Mike Budenholzer. And that sent shockwaves throughout the NBA, throughout NBA fans, NBA media. How do you feel? Just quickly, thoughts on the firing. Was it fair to you? Do you blame Bud for the first round loss? How are you feeling about what happened?
Yeah, I think Milwaukee, they had a choice to make after they were a top three seed in the East. And just to put it plain and simple, they lost to a Miami team that lost their first play-in game. That's not good enough. I mean, frankly, that plain and simple, that's not good enough. I understand Giannis was hurt. He did not play. I think he only played 3 games or something, right?
Yeah, he didn't play games 2 and 3. He played 1, 4, and 5.
Okay, yeah. So he didn't play 2 games during that series, but...
And he got hurt. I can remember exactly when in game 1, but he didn't play a lot of game 1 either, if I remember correctly. I might be wrong.
Yeah. Okay, yeah, yeah. He was hobbled for a lot of that series. And so when we asked the question of, like, was it really Bud's fault, I don't think not entirely, right? But it's also the job of a coach to make adjustments when something is off. Miami had one of their best shooting series during when they faced off against Milwaukee, and Budenholzer, he just didn't do anything to try and stop that. He let Miami have open shots every single game, and he just let himself get walked down. And it's kind of a pattern. It's been 4 times that Bud's teams have held a top seed and have been knocked off by the lower seed. It's just too much underperforming. I understand he won a championship with the squad. He is clearly a championship coach in this league. But championships don't give you job security. You can't simply just win a championship and be mediocre and expect to keep your job. In my honest opinion, I think Milwaukee, they took a look in the mirror and they realized we have an MVP level talent in Giannis, and a lot of other teams want him in this league, and he clearly wants to win. That's at the forefront of Giannis's mind, and we have to do everything that we can to build a championship team around him. And Bud is simply just not good enough. I think that first round exit just kind of was the nail in the coffin there. Bud has underperformed way too much with his team, even given the injuries. Even given that their star player is injured, there's no reason you should lose to the 8 seed, to that seed. I mean, there's no reason. Even if your star player is injured, Milwaukee still has the personnel to defeat Miami. And there's just too much underperforming in Miami, Milwaukee. Oh my gosh, sorry. Can you tell it's a Monday morning?
But it's all good, dude.
Milwaukee just kind of realized that we can't sit here and be mediocre, or else Giannis is going to ask out.
Yeah, I've been saying it a lot, but it's another good point that you raise. I mean, point blank, Eric Spoelstra outcoached the hell out of Mike Budenholzer. Yeah. I mean, just. It was like a masterclass of coaching a series, a playoff series, and he owned Coach Bud, like absolutely owned him. And, you know, yeah, their first seed in the regular season had a very good regular season. Entering the playoffs, he just kind of wrote them into the Eastern Conference Final because they didn't have to face Boston or Philly in the second round. So you kind of just assumed, you just penciled them in, or maybe even penned them in to the Eastern Conference Final. And for that performance to occur, again, you know, devil's advocate, Giannis getting hurt, back issues are no joke. Like, they're no joke. If you have a hurt back, that changes everything about your life. And to even, you could tell he was hobbled. Like, he was still playing through it. He played his best, but you could tell he wasn't the same. But even then, I agree with you that they should have still beaten the Miami Heat. But it just wasn't. He wasn't good enough, and if that's the decision of the Milwaukee Bucks front office, their ownership, to look back and think to themselves, he's just not good enough to coach this team anymore. Maybe he was. Well, obviously he was. He led him to a title, but now he's not good enough. And you know, I think it's a decision that it reminded me of a Premier League team and how cutthroat Premier League teams are with firing managers. They're so cutthroat, dude. Like, look at what Chelsea... I'm a big Chelsea fan, as you may know. But, like, they fired Thomas Tuchel after winning the Champions League. Like, the season after. Like, come on. Are you serious? That's nuts.
Yeah.
Like, because they thought that he wasn't good enough to coach the team. They had a bad run of form, and he was... So they let him go. And this was, like, that kind of, like, Premier League cutthroat decision where, like, yeah, thank you for that championship you delivered us 3 years ago. That means a lot to us. Obviously, you were a massive part in that. But currently... you're not good enough to coach this team. Bye. And it's a harsh. And, you know, I think someone in his family died. I can't remember. Do you remember off the top of your head?
His brother. Yeah, his brother died in a car accident.
That is horrific. I can't even imagine what he was going through mentally throughout that. So, yeah, that's terrible. Like, I understand. I can't even imagine what he was going through mentally to try and coach a playoff series with his brother dying in a car accident. That's just terrible. But at the same time, it's just, I get it. So it's like, was it fair? It's hard to say. Like, it's hard to say if it was fair, but it was their decision.
Yeah.
It's what they chose. Any other thoughts on Bud before we move on?
I mean, I think you hit the nail on the head perfectly right. I think the question isn't about, like, is this fair? It's about, like, can Milwaukee keep Giannis? I think that's at the forefront of their mind. Giannis Antetokounmpo is a generational player. We've never seen anyone like him in the NBA. And, of course, the Bucks realize what they have. And they have to do everything in their power to keep Giannis. They're a small market team. They don't, like, typically attract free agents. So it's not about, like, was it fair, right? It's just about, well, what do we need to do to keep Giannis happy and satisfied? And clearly a first round exit is not going to do that.
Right. And you know, to that point, look at Memphis, another small market team with a generational type player. I like Coach Jenkins, and he's young in his head coaching career.
Yeah.
But clock's ticking. We know it. Clock's ticking. You know, if he underperforms next season, if they have a lackluster regular season, or they bow out early in the playoffs again, I wouldn't be surprised. I don't think you would be either to see him let go from the Grizzlies. So,
oh no, man.
You know, clock's ticking on Jenkins as well, and I like him. Yeah. I think he's a great guy. I think he embodies Memphis really well, and I think he seems like a really good person. So I love that he coaches the Grizzlies. Because he just seems like an awesome guy on top of being a good basketball coach.
Yeah.
But, you know, clock's ticking. So Yeah. All right. Let's move on to another series in the first round that caught a lot of headlines. Sacramento versus Golden State. Sacramento went up 2-0. They won both their games at home. You know, light the beam. The beam was lit.
Light the
beam. It was going. Sacramento was jumping. And then they go back to Golden State to go to Oracle, and they lose. They lose. It gets tied up 2-2. And then Golden State wins a road game. Like, breaking news. Golden State won a road game. They won game 5 at Sacramento. And we all kind of just thought, all right, I mean, they're going to take care of business at home. Wow. I mean, the Warriors are the Warriors. Impressive. They actually won a road game. Nope. Sacramento has probably one of the greatest game 6 performances, being down 3-2 on the road. It's so impressive what they did to win game 6. They win it easily. They blew them out. And yeah, game 7 was a tight one, but Golden State pulled away and they shut that beam down. They shut that thing down. They didn't let them light that thing. So, you know, from your perspective, and we'll be quick because we still have, you know, second round stuff to talk about. Yeah. But was that series more so Golden State's experience and playoff pedigree coming to the forefront? Or was it Sacramento's inexperience coming to the forefront? Or a bit of both? How do you feel?
I'd say a bit of both, but I definitely lean towards the championship pedigree just shining for Golden State. They just knew exactly what to do down the stretch. Stephen Curry scored 16 points in that second half. And it's just like special players make special plays, and they know when to make them. In comparison, De'Aaron Fox only scored 2 in the fourth quarter. Sabonis only scored 6 in the fourth. For the Kings, it just kind of looked like Fox and Sabonis, they couldn't kind of keep that magic going that propelled them throughout the series. For Sabonis, they forced him to take a ton of mid-range jumpers that he just wasn't comfortable with. He couldn't get to that like left hook or his signature shot there. Their two best players just didn't turn up when they needed them to for Sacramento. And in comparison, Golden State, they locked in. They knew what to do. And I thought Mike Brown, he didn't play Davion Mitchell, who was one of his best defenders on the team, on Stephen Curry, especially, and just watched Stephen Curry like cook that team in the second half and just didn't put him in. So I just got to say, like, Golden State locked in. They knew what to do. I'm sure you saw like that speech Stephen Curry gave his teammates before they like hopped on the bus to Sacramento. He just kind of very motivating, very inspiring. You know, if anyone's listening, wants to look that up. But they knew what to do. I mean, they've been here before. They knew the place to make. Steph knew the shots to make, and it all came together. You know.
Yeah, I agree. It was an absolute masterpiece from Stephen Curry in game 7. I mean, the shots that he takes and makes are just still to this day absolutely mind-blowing. It's the definition of no. Yes, like the shots that he takes, just oh my goodness. I just can't. It's as a fan of a rival team, it's frustrating, but as an NBA fan, it's poetic. It's beautiful. You know, it's trying to find that balance as a Grizzlies fan. And, you know, I'm rooting for the Lakers against the Warriors because, you know, just straight up. But either way, it's just so – he's poetry in motion, Stephen Curry. You know, it's a – we don't have enough time to go into the debate if he's top 10 of all time. but you can make the argument. That's for damn sure. You know, you can make the argument that he's up there. You know, best point guard of all time.
Give me one more ring. Give me one more ring.
And there you go. That might be what it takes for people. But, he's so good. And the Kings just, you know, De'Aaron Fox got hurt. So, he didn't seem the same, kind of similar issue with Ja. He just didn't look the same after his injury. So that played a part into it as well, of course. And as you mentioned, Sabonis just, you know, the Warriors just said, hey, you want to take 18-footers? Sure. Go for it. You know, you want to take an elbow jump shot? Uncontested, sure, dude, go for it, do whatever you want from out there, and it worked. So I agree. I think it was more so Golden State pedigree coming to the forefront for the Warriors to win that series. But all right, so second round stuff, And obviously, I love this time of the season. Playoff basketball, it's at its peak. We're really ramping up. It's getting, absolutely. So, you know, let's start with the Nuggets and the Phoenix Suns. So initially, in my write-up for the podcast, I always do a write-up before episodes just so, you know, I know what we're doing. Guests know. Co-host Grant and Connor know what they're doing, obviously. I initially wrote Francis Brandt on the Suns because I was ready, Brandon. I was ready to come on this podcast and just write the Phoenix Suns obituary. I was pumped. I was pumped because I have been telling people for a long time, for weeks, years, that the Suns are a fake basketball team. That is a fake basketball team. They realized it. That's why they had to trade for Kevin Durant. And look, they're still very good. KD is the best plug-and-play superstar in the NBA. So now that I said that, everyone listening has to take a shot. Everyone listening has to take a shot because that's the phrase that's said on every podcast for the past, 2 months. So, yes, this is a good team. Obviously, probably the favorite to win the West coming into the NBA playoffs because of KD, Booker, Chris Paul. But I was ready to write them off, man, because Chris Paul got hurt again. Mm-hmm. I say this all the time. You cannot count on Chris Paul in the playoffs, not because of his play, but because of his injury history. Yeah. You can't trust him. And I say that all the time. That's why I can never trust the Phoenix Suns to win, to get over that hump, even with KD, because I couldn't trust Chris Paul. And what did the Nuggets do even when Chris Paul was healthy? They did what I wanted them to do and say, hey, Chris Paul, you beat us. You want to take mid-range jump shots? You want to take contested threes? Blah, blah, blah. Go for it. Anyone but KD and Devin Booker beat us, especially if it's you, Chris Paul. You want to beat us? Cool. And then Denver goes up 2-0, and I am ready, Brandon, to come on this pod and just write up the obituary and get on my soapbox, and they shut me the hell up. They shut me up. They won two in a row at Phoenix. KD goes, he looks like KD again. Devin Booker has a great game 4, has 36 points, 12 assists. KD had 36 points, 11 rebounds. So both of them had a double-double. Devin Booker was instrumental with his playmaking, which is a facet of his game that I've been clamoring for him to improve. And he's shown it, you know, he's shown it. And it was impressive to see them win two games at home when they needed it. They needed to win these two games to make this still a series. So now we go back game 5, and who knows? You know, I haven't been checking my phone because we've obviously been doing the pod, but I don't think, as I quickly scroll, nope, there's no news on Jokic, and if he's been suspended, is that?
Oh, yeah.
We don't know. Right? Yeah,
I'm waiting for that.
Owner said Jokic shouldn't be suspended. Okay, so the owner said that, but let's see what the NBA does. Because, who knows what happens there. Yeah. So, you know, we've got a series. That's to say the very least. Chris Paul will come back, I think, game 5 or game 6. But he should come back at some point in this series. So, my obituary of the Suns is on hold. It is on hold.
I have to keep it in the drafts, man.
Trust me, Brandon. It is ready. It is locked and loaded. When the time comes. Oh, I'm rooting for the Nuggets so hard because I am ready to. I'm ready, Brandon, to write this team off. And not because nothing against Booker or nothing against KD or even. Well, no, it's fully against Chris Paul. I hate Chris Paul, so it's fully against him. I do not like Chris Paul. So it's not against Booker, not against KD, not against Suns fans. Just more so how I've always felt about this team. But all right, question for you, Brandon. Does the winner of this series win the Western Conference?
Yes. Yes.
Ooh.
Yes. Yeah. I'm firm on that one. Yes.
Okay. Why? Talk to me.
Yeah. I mean, we talk about just like high level shot making and high level offensive output. Fun stat that I found on the Twitterverse yesterday. Devin Booker has become the first player in NBA history to average 35 or more points per game on 70%+ true shooting over a 9-game span. He's truly sensational right now.
Yeah.
And then, of course, Jokic just put up 53 points last night. I just think the level of offensive creation and just shot making in this series is far above what we're seeing, frankly, in any playoff series. And then you have Booker and KD, who are simply the best scoring duo in the playoffs right now. And I believe Phoenix has the two best players on the floor in this series, just overall. So I definitely think whoever wins this series is coming out of the West. I think just like in terms of offensive versatility, offensive creation, the players in this series are head and shoulders above the Lakers Warriors series. And so I have Phoenix in seven for this series. I think Booker and KD, like I said, simply the best scoring duo in the league right now. I think they're one of the most dominant duos. Let me put my hot take alert, warning. But I think they're one of the most dominant duos we've seen in the NBA since Kobe and Shaq. No, they don't have the titles. They don't have the glory. They don't have all of that. But I mean, you're just talking about two of the best scorers to ever play the game, man.
Sure. Yeah. I'm with you. I can see that. Yeah, I can see that. Go ahead. Sorry to cut you off.
Yeah, no, I mean, I was finishing up there, but like, okay. Yeah, I just like, I think whoever wins this series is the favorite just because the level of offense we're seeing in this series right now, it's beautiful basketball, absolute cinema, as the kids say, but I just think that the offense we're seeing in this series is way above like anything we've seen this playoffs.
Yeah, I I don't know if I can say that so gung-ho, man, because I think the West is so wide open because I think the Lakers are very good. I think this is a very good basketball team. Mm-hmm. Obviously, the Warriors are the Warriors, and they're starting to click at the right time. They're healthy. You know, Wiggins is making that defensive, offensive impact that they need him to. Yeah. Steph is still Steph. Klay, Klay's there, and he'll have his moments, and that's all. I mean, I don't know if you need Klay to look like prime Klay Thompson for the Warriors to win a championship. They just need him to be good, and he's been good so far. And then defensively, I think the Lakers and Warriors are two good defensive teams. And Denver, their defense, their scheme around Jokic is actually really impressive. They're switching really well. They're kind of hiding Jokic's his defensive deficiencies very well with how they switch and how they talk and communicate on the defensive side. Mike Malone's a great coach. He's an awesome coach. And obviously, offensively, that's a very good team. Phoenix, again, like you said, Devin Booker and KD are just, it's insane. When they're clicking, how the hell do you guard that? I mean, you kind of hope that Chris Paul's on the floor to kind of just funnel buckets to Chris Paul because they're just so good. KD and Devin Booker are so good together. I still don't trust Phoenix's bench. You know, that was a big reason why they won game four. Yeah. Landry Shamet was crazy.
Yeah, Jock turned Landale. To prime Klay Thompson last night.
Yeah,
right?
For real. Like, freaking Jock Landale, who looks like Birdman and Machine Gun Kelly had a baby.
Yeah.
Like, it's crazy. He was impactful. Terrence Ross hit a couple threes. So that their bench, who I don't fully trust throughout the rest of the playoffs, they'll need to be really good. But, you know, Denver has their issues as well. They need Michael Porter Jr. to hit shots. Jamal Murray needs to hit shots, obviously. Yeah.
Jamal Murray has been pretty inefficient. He's been rather inefficient in this series. But I'm keeping my eye on that, you know.
Yeah, for sure. And I it's kind of like a similar thing for the Grizzlies when you have a superstar like Grizzlies have Ja, Denver has Jokic. A lot of the attention's on them. So when the attention's on them, you got to hit open shots. And if Denver's not hitting open shots around Jokic, then, you know, Jokic is a generational passer, so you can still find people cutting. But we know the value of a three-pointer in the NBA. You need to hit threes.
Yeah.
So, you know, Denver's got to hit open threes to win this series. They've got to get, you know, KCP was great in game two and game one, but really game two against the Phoenix Suns. And you kind of need that throughout the rest of the series to release the pressure off of Jokic. And Jokic was insane. I don't know. I personally can't say it with as much conviction as you. I think it's hard. It's a very wide open wide open Western Conference. But you had Phoenix in seven in this series, correct?
Yes, I do. I do have Phoenix in seven.
Okay.
I think KD and Booker are just they're going ape shit right now.
Okay.
No one can stop them.
Okay. I'll go Denver in seven. Just, you know, they have home court, and I want to give my obituary to the Suns. So I'm really hard.
Understandable.
For Denver to win this one. All right, so let's move on, and we had awesome conversation, and I don't want this to go on massively too much longer, yep. But we still got other series. So Heat Knicks, quick from my perspective, I need to apologize to Jimmy Butler. I need to apologize to my co-host Grant Hechinger, who, and I think Connor's a big Jimmy Butler guy as well. So I apologize to both of them. Are you a Jimmy Butler guy, Brandon?
Oh,
so
yeah.
So I need to apologize to you as well, yeah. Because I was wrong on my takes on Jimmy Butler. I've gone on this pod, I've gone on other podcasts, and I've said that Jimmy Butler isn't that guy. You can't win a championship with Jimmy Butler as your best player. Like I know, and I'm sorry. I was wrong. I'll happily admit when I'm wrong, and I was wrong. He's been incredible. And shout out to freaking Heat culture. So everyone take another shot. I said KD's a plug-and-play superstar or best plug-and-play player. And then I said Heat culture. So both of those have been said on this pod. The Heat and their culture, it just permeates through the whole franchise because you're getting contribution from Max Strus, Gabe Vincent, and Kyle Lowry with his large rear end is really effective in the post as well. Shout out to the Heat. They're up 2-1 on the New York Knicks.
Yeah.
I think they gotta, you know, it's gonna be a pivotal game four, obviously. What's your key? What's a key for the series for the Knicks to get back into it tonight?
I think plain and simple, Randall's gotta show up. He looks like he's playing passive right now. He's just taking bad shots, not in the flow of the offense. He's just not playing team ball, and that's, you're not going to win games that way. If the guy who's supposed to be your second best player is just not engaged. I understand he's coming off an injury. So he's still getting back into the swing of things himself, but he's just got to show up. He has not done that for the past two games, and when he doesn't do that, New York's not going to win. And then also Emmanuel Quickly as well. He's got to show up. I know he also has some injury concerns he's dealing with too. But he has scored single digits aside from game three. He needs to be that scoring punch off the bench for New York. Sixth man of the year candidate. Really important, just kind of offensive igniter. But he hasn't really gotten it going except for game three. But those are kind of my two keys for the Knicks to get back into the series.
Yeah, and I agree, especially with Randall. I mean, that was my biggest key. He just needs, like you said, he just needs to be more aggressive offensively scoring the ball. And then, you know, Jalen Brunson, he had a good game two at New York, and then he wasn't good in game three for New York against at Miami. So, you know, their two-headed punch, Jalen Brunson, Jimmy is the best player in the series. But Jalen Brunson and Julius Randle, they need to be the next two best players by a pretty wide margin. Like, there can't even be like, oh, is Caleb? Well, what's his name? Gabe Vincent or Max Strus? Are they like?
I get them confused too.
It's so confusing. They have Caleb Martin, and it's just It's so confusing. Gabe Vincent, Caleb Martin, Max Strus. It's like one of those tongue twisters. You have to say them like five times fast to get your vocal cords loosened up. But Randall and Brunson have to be the two best players on the Knicks, obviously, but they need to be the two right below Jimmy Butler for the next two best players for the entire series. They're vital. So let's see what happens tonight, game four. They show some heart and take one on the road to tie it up. Cool. All right. So, quick prediction. So, Harry, what's your prediction for the series?
Oh yeah, I've got I got Heat in six. Like you said, they have the best player in this series, and the best coach. Those teams usually win the playoff series. So, Heat in six.
Yeah, I think I'm going Heat in six as well. You know, as I have a lot of Knicks fans, friends who are Knicks fans. That made a lot more sense. Friends who are Knicks fans. And, you know, I liked seeing them happy. I like seeing them enjoying playoff basketball. But they just need Randall and Brunson to be incredible. And
shout out Chris LeBron.
Yeah, for real. Shout out Chris LeBron. So my guy. So, I mean, I feel bad for picking against the Knicks. I feel bad doing it, but I'm gonna pick the Heat in six as well. And shout out Spoelstra. He's Filipino. So, you know, I always got to love Eric Spoelstra putting on for my country, my people.
Coaching masterclass this playoffs. Absolutely.
He's so
just like,
he's
man.
Just so good.
So like, good.
I don't think he's not on the Mount Rushmore of coaches. No, he's not on Mount Rushmore, but he's like, it's got to be top 10, right? I feel like he's got to at least top, you know, at the worst, top 20. He's such a good coach. All right.
Great coach.
So, yeah, great coach. All right, Lakers, Warriors. Quickly, what are you looking out for when you watch this series? I mean, it's been a very, it's been damn good so far. So, and I think the, you know, Anthony Davis needs to be very good. He needs to be very consistent. But, you know, what about you? What are you looking out for this series?
First thing I'm looking for are actually points off turnovers. That's a huge key to Golden State success. As getting out in transition, forcing those turnovers. But LA has won that battle in every game thus far. So it seems like LA is kind of beating Golden State at their own game, so to speak. They're pushing the pace, which we wouldn't really expect, right, for LA. I joke and call them LA AARP. But,
oh, my God.
But points off turnovers. LA is looking, they're looking really good there. That Laker defense, as you mentioned, it's really stout. It's like, I'd say, like, what defines that team the most is their defensive intensity, is the Lakers' defensive intensity. So I'm going to continue looking at that, how they're guarding Steph, how they're guarding Klay. They're switching things up. They have started with Troy Brown on Klay. Now they're moving towards Austin Reeves on Klay. So I'm going to continue to just kind of monitor those defensive coverages. And also, like you said, how AD and LeBron have been. LeBron, of course, LeBron, he's my greatest player of all time. He has not been that, like, supernova, take over a game 2016 LeBron.
Sure.
He's averaging 22 right now. But he's, of course, finding other ways to impact the game because, I think how AD performs ties into this too. If AD is the best player on the floor, the Lakers win. And I think the key that Darvin Ham is clearly going for is to make AD that best player on the floor night in, night out. So I'm monitoring how AD is performing night in, night out. Is he being that best player on the floor? Of course, he had a bounce back game three after a not very great game two. So I'm monitoring that from AD, how he's performing game after game. And then lastly, the free throws. If you're a Memphis Grizzlies fan, you know this wide and true.
The Lakers
have 213 attempts this postseason, while their opponents combined have 160 thus far. So I'm watching those free throws, seeing just how the Lakers are getting to the line so frequently. But just to kind of sum this all up, really just looking at how AD and LeBron are performing. LeBron actually had that first 20-point, 8-assist, 8-rebound, 0-turnover game like ever in that last game. So he's finding other ways to affect the game, but clearly, like, he has a better supporting cast now. He doesn't need to do as much, you know, to, like, take over a game and really be explosive, you know, especially, like, coming off that, like, bad foot. And so I'm just watching how if AD is really going to turn into that number one player on this Lakers team, game in, game out.
Yeah, when my key for the Grizzlies to beat the Lakers was Jaren Jackson Jr., he had to be incredible. He had to win the matchup against Anthony Davis. And I think the key for the Lakers in terms of their playoff championship hopes is Anthony Davis.
Yeah.
If AD is the best player on the floor in each of the series that they play, then they win. It's really that simple. Because AD had, we all know how good he can be. We all know that. We all know his ceiling is just astronomical. but it's his inconsistencies that are maddening.
Yeah.
Just absolutely maddening for NBA fans to watch, especially for Lakers fans who, you know, live, eat, breathe, drink the Lakers. It's maddening for them. But if he can be consistent, like you said, and be that defensive, offensive, two-way superstar, then, you know, they'll win this series. I really believe that. You know, your point on their defense, and it kind of like goes for the key for Golden State. They've got to get just better looks for Steph.
Yeah.
They've got to figure out a way to get him better looks because the Lakers are hounding him. They're absolutely hounding him.
Dude, he can't get a shot off.
No, he can't. And if he gets, and, you know, like I said before, he's the ultimate no, 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 yes type of player. But if you're doing those no, no, no shots against Malik Monk, then who cares? Who cares? Yeah,
right.
But if you're doing those no, no, no shots against Jared Vanderbilt, who's 6'7", long ass wingspan, no, like that. Yeah. Those are not good looks. Because
shout out Vanderbilt, man.
He's doing a great job in
his defensive coverage.
Absolutely, he's probably the best trade pickup of the season by any team. Like he's the best pickup by any team because Jared Vanderbilt is a Swiss Army knife who can guard anybody on the wing. He's not a good interior defender. We saw like Jared Vanderbilt up when he had Vanderbilt on him in the post. But perimeter defense, especially if you have like that shifty guard, like a John Morant, like a Stephen Curry, you need someone to just be a shadow throughout the entire game. He's the perfect guy for that. He has length, he has quickness, he has athleticism, he has defensive instincts. I mean, yeah, he's a really good foil to everything Stephen Curry does well. And the Warriors have to be more creative in terms of getting him looks. You know, Klay's got to get hot too, because he, like I said, he's been fine, but I think he definitely has to be better.
Needs to be that game two Klay. That we saw, you know, that
absolutely
reminded me of his like OKC game where he hit those 11 3-pointers. You know, like
for sure,
he needs
to
be that guy, that vintage Klay, every game.
Yeah, he at the very least has to just be better. Like he was not good game three at all. So he just has to be better. I know it's an oversimplification, but
yeah.
I mean it's true. He just has to hit shots. And you know, I think this will be a very interesting series. So I'll give my prediction. I will go I'm gonna go Lakers in six.
Okay.
I think defensively it's actually a really good matchup for him. Like I said, Jared Vanderbilt is a great guy to guard Steph Curry. The Golden State doesn't have an answer for Anthony Davis. Just straight up. They don't have an answer for him.
Nope.
I'll go Lakers in six. What about you?
I'm going Lakers in seven. I think it's gonna be super close. Like a hair. But like you said, I think the Lakers defense is just really peaking at the right time right now. They're covering Steph and Klay fairly well. Warriors don't have an answer for AD. The Lakers are also generally winning that rebounding battle. They're pushing the pace, really forcing the Warriors to match up with them. So Lakers in seven. I do expect the Warriors to bounce back. They've been in the spot before. They're gonna get their mojo back. But Lakers in seven, really close series.
Okay, cool. Sounds good. All right, last series, Boston Celtics versus the Philadelphia 76ers. That series is tied 2-2 after an awesome game four last night.
Classic. Where playoff classic, man.
Utterly fantastic basketball. Really fun to watch. It had everything you ask for in a basketball game. Look, you can question Harden as much as you want, and I definitely have, but he's been really good this series, and it's been really impressive to watch.
Mm-hmm.
Him knock down shots, him ISO ball and beat James Harden. Like, that's what Philly needs.
Yeah.
That's what Philly needs. I think what I really liked was after the game one win on the road, without Embiid, where Harden was just absolutely, like, he looked like prime Harden.
Yeah.
I love that after they won, he was like telling everyone in the Sixers, like, get back to the locker room. Like, don't celebrate this. Like, come back. You know, it's just one game. And I love that. Like, I love that. That showed some maturity and understanding of the moment that, you know, you need in the playoffs. It's a big road win. No one thought you were going to win that game. No, nobody. And to do that and shock the world, you know, there was no beating of the chest. There was no, you know, dancing in the Boston Garden. It was just like, no, that's a win. Let's go. We got to win three more games. So I love that. And I think that boded well for set the tone for Harden to continue to have a really good series. Embiid is looking good. He's still looking like Joel Embiid. I think there's a little bit of hobbleness with Embiid from his injury, but I think he'll click. It'll click for him too. Yeah. This is a tight series. It's a toss up really to me.
Yeah. Embiid's at like he's playing, clearly playing at like 85%. He mentioned this is a type of injury that keeps you out like 4 to 6 weeks, but I'm just playing through it, you know, because he has to, you know?
Yeah, I agree. He has to. And you know, credit to him for doing so. And for the Sixers finding a way to stay in this series. I mean, 2-2 going back to Boston. I think it's going to be a classic series. I'll ask you a question from a Boston perspective and then give predictions. Yeah. How important is this series / playoffs for Jason Tatum's legacy, in your opinion?
Okay, so when I think legacy, I wouldn't say his legacy is going to be like heavily impacted, right? Like Tatum has already made 3 conference finals in his career. He's already made a final series. Clearly, he's a top 10 player in this league, one of the best young players in this league. So I wouldn't say his legacy will be like heavily impacted based off of the outcome of this series. But I do think his performance and is going to raise questions. How he performs going to raise questions as to who the best player on Boston really is, right? Yeah. I say this mainly because Tatum had that 7-point game, right? And that's not an anomaly. Like he's had these kind of games where he's just not as offensively aggressive as he normally is, you know? In the context of the series, yes, it's kind of an outlier, but I'm seeing these conversations of like, who is really the best player in Boston? Is it Jaylen Brown or is it Jason Tatum? You know, like those questions are being raised. And so I think his performance is going to kind of like answer and ignite kind of those questions as to who the best player on Boston really is. But I mean, there's clearly Tatum is a great player, but you know, like, is he going to take a back seat at certain moments when he should clearly be the number one guy on this team?
Yeah, and you know, legacy questions are always difficult because it's just one series in the grand scheme of everything, and he's still a young player with a bright future. Like you said, one of the best players in the NBA, top 10 at the very worst, you know, at best, top 5 at best. He's a very good player, obviously. So, you know, legacy questions are hard. And I'm someone who, I'm a big Jason Tatum guy. I'm a big supportive of him. I have always loved his game. Fun fact, I remember watching a Boston playoff game when I was younger, and I watched it with my mom, and she was like, "Who's that? Who's that player?" Like, I was like, "Mom, that's Jason Tatum." And she was like, "Oh, I like him. I like Jason Tatum." And that's exactly how she would say it, Tatum. I'm like, "Yeah, he's really good." And she was like, "He's very smooth." I'm like, "Yeah, Jason Tatum is very smooth. You're right, Mom.
Smooth game.
And smooth game. Like, he's a really good hooper." But I think kind of like the AD thing, a little bit of consistency issues, especially for Jason Tatum near the end of the regular season this year. Mm-hmm. You know, he was in the MVP debate for the midway through the season, and then it just changed. It dropped out entirely. Yeah, he started playing too much ISO ball, taking too many contested threes, not working within the flow of the offense, and you know, Boston hit a bit of a slide throughout the latter part of the season. And a part of that was due to the shot selection of Tatum. You know, and I feel like if they do lose this series, I think Jason Tatum would be why. You know, and if they win the series, I think Jason Tatum will be a big reason why as well. So, he's the most important player in this series. The Celtics will go as far as he takes them. Absolutely. If he doesn't find his superstardom that he has as the series goes on, I think Philly can win this in 6 because Embiid's going to get healthier. Harden, he's looking like prime Harden.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's gonna be some questions.
Yeah.
You know, but I still I have faith in Tatum. I think Boston wins this series in seven. I think it goes the distance. I think Tatum has this moment. He has a superstar moment. Him and Jaylen Brown coexist, and okay. they win in seven. So that's my prediction. What about you?
Okay. Yeah, I'm feeling. You know, I'm feeling a little spicy today, so I'm gonna say Sixers and six, man.
Okay.
I think Philly is just really tired of being that little brother to Boston, right?
Yeah.
As they've normally been like knocked out in these playoffs. I think Harden, like you said, he's moving differently. He has something to prove. You know, he wants to beat these washed allegations. You know, which are totally ridiculous. But I digress. But I think Philly is just really tired of being the Celtics' little brother, and they really want to move aggressively and win this series. So I've got Philly in six, and Embiid will get healthier. I expect Harden to continue to put up monster performances. Maxey also looks the part. He's looking really good. So I say Sixers in six.
Okay. Cool. Fair. Absolutely fair enough. I mean, and there's a part of me that definitely hopes you're right, because that just creates turmoil for Jaylen Brown. And, you know, maybe they would be willing to trade him. And there's a certain team that we support that we would love to. I would love to have Jaylen Brown. I don't know if I'd do it at the expense of Desmond Bain, as I've been seeing on Twitter a little bit.
Yeah, I wouldn't.
I don't know if I'd do that. But I would still adore to have Jaylen Brown added to this roster. That only happens if the Celtics flame out of the NBA playoffs. That only happens. So,
you know, I'll keep this quick, but like, I do think in terms of Jaylen Brown, I think he wants to be the number one at the end of the day, right?
Yeah.
Like, I think he wants to be that guy on the team. Like, he's seeing McCall in Brooklyn. He's seeing what he's doing, how he's going and completely reinventing himself. I think if Jaylen Brown were ever to leave Boston, it would be to be a number one. And that's why, like, I don't think, like, he'd want to, like, come to the Grizzlies or really, like, be with Memphis, just because, like, he'd be, like, a second or third fiddle to Ja. Like, I think Jaylen wants to be the guy night in, night out, have an offense built around him.
Sure.
So those are just my thoughts on Jaylen.
No, I get it. That's totally fair. It would take buy-in for sure if he were to one day be a Memphis Grizzly. But, yeah, again, we digress. digress. All right, man. That was awesome. Definitely loved our conversation. Loved talking hoops with you. You know, as I close this episode, tell the people where they can find you.
Yeah. So I am very active on the Twitterverse, as I like to call it. Just my name, at Brandon_Wakiji. Talk basketball, talk hoops. Shout out Luke Hatmaker with the No Bluffin' Pod, another great Grizzlies podcast. But he coined me the professor of Grizzology for Bluff City Media. So, I'm also I write a lot for Bluff City Media. We've got some really exciting, cool things coming up from both me and my guy Francis. You can find me on there.
Cool. Like, absolutely. Everyone, you're on Twitter. You go follow Brandon. Interact with him. He's an awesome guy, just a great guy to talk to, not just obviously in person or through a laptop. I call this in person, you know, telecommunicating world. But definitely he's a great guy to talk with just on Twitter. So everyone, you don't follow Brandon, that's your fault. You gotta go follow the guy for great basketball knowledge, and just follow a good dude, to say the very least. But again, Brandon, thank you so much for coming on the pod. Connor, Grant, much love to both of you. Hopefully we can get back together soon and do the pod as the playoffs go forward. But, it's been your boy, Francis Carlotta. Find me at Slug of Sports on Twitter and Up and Under Podcast on Instagram. Be sure to like the podcast. Give us 5 stars. Comment. If you can, I don't know. Subscribe to the pod, please. That would make me very happy. But until next time, peace. Cool days, hot tops, with my blue face. Ice pops, I'ma make a shoelace, necklace, yeah, we whipping pops on Lexus, and I'm skipping school days, mic drops, eyes on summer like Cyclops, yeah, we falling off the sidewalk, mama wants a home boy, nightfall. The Up and Under Podcast is proud to be a part of Off the Ball Network. For all things basketball, football, soccer, golf, baseball, sports betting, you name it, go to offtheballnetwork.com and check out the amazing articles posted by writers of the network, including yours truly, and the other podcasts on basically every sport under the sun. Off the Ball Network, your home for quality sports and entertainment content. SeatGeek is the newest sponsor of Off the Ball Network. If you're listening to this podcast, there's a 99.9% chance you love sports. But watching these games in person is super expensive. To help ease the pain in your wallet, use the promo code OFFTHEBALLNETWORK to get a $20 discount for first-time users of SeatGeek. Your next best night ever is waiting, and SeatGeek has the tickets.